From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, defending U.S. policy. UN welcomes Ukraine election. African Union starting a campaign to reduce child marriage. Plus, New York City's Harlem mourns and cherishes Maya Angelou. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Obama says the United States is still the world's most indispensable nation, but cautions against further military interventions around the globe. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez has our report.
The president used a commencement address at this year's U.S. Military Academy graduation to defend his foreign policy. Critics have called that policy unclear and weak. They point to Mr. Obama's decision not to follow through on threats to attack Syria when it used chemical weapons and for failing to stop Russia from interfering in Ukraine, all while China asserts territorial claims in the East and South China Seas. Mr. Obama said terrorism remains the biggest direct threat to the United States and indicated the U.S. needs to stay engaged in places like the Middle East and Africa for its own security.
I believe that a world of greater freedom and tolerance is not only a moral imperative, it also helps to keep us safe. But to say that we have an interest in pursuing peace and freedom beyond our borders is not to say that every problem has a military solution.
President Obama said the United States will continue drone strikes against terrorists when necessary to protect U.S. interests, but only when there is a near certainty that no civilians are harmed. Mr. Obama said he would work to boost support for Syrian opposition groups and for efforts to support Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, which have been hosting refugees and confronting terrorists working across Syria's borders. The president called for Congress to support a new $5 billion plan to help nations including Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and Mali fight terrorists. It is in Congress where Mr. Obama faces much of the criticism on his foreign policy. Analyst Michael O'Hanlon says the president's decisions to avoid military action in places like Syria and Ukraine have been in keeping with polls that find Americans are tired of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and do not support more military adventures.
But the problem is when you do each one of those things individually like that and then you add up the whole picture, it starts to look a little weak. And then you're open to the charge that foreign leaders have figured out you don't want to do much, and they're exploiting that window of opportunity, which is, of course, the charge being made about why Putin got so aggressive on the Crimea.
The West Point speech came a day after the president announced his decision to leave 9,800 U.S. troops in Afghanistan after December and complete a full withdrawal by the end of 2016. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai is welcoming President Obama's decision to pull all American troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2016. Mr. Karzai issued a statement Wednesday saying ending the U.S. military presence in his country has been a longtime goal of the Afghan government as well as the people. He also said he was grateful for international community's contributions and support to his country. Appearing Wednesday on U.S. television, Secretary of State John Kerry struck out at critics of Mr. Obama's decision, saying the timeline is not an abandonment of Afghanistan, but an empowerment of the country.
Everything that has been accomplished in Afghanistan in the last 5 years has been accomplished with a deadline. When President Obama came in, there was no policy. The president increased the troops, put a policy in place, and set a deadline for the Afghans to be able to take over security. Guess what? They met the deadline.
For some analysis of all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Arturo Munoz, who believes Mr. Obama's announcement is no surprise, as he has argued for an end of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan throughout his presidency. But Munoz says the president has been receiving conflicting advice, with some arguing for another 10-year U.S. presence in Afghanistan, recalling how Washington walked away in the 1980s from arming the Mujahideen, who successfully forced occupying Soviet forces out.
And then everybody knows the result. You know, you had a civil war among the Mujahideen, and then you had the Taliban. So then we had to go back to Afghanistan. So a lot of people are saying that to prevent that scenario, we need to stay engaged for a long period. Now, that does not mean combat troops. Nobody wants to do combat troops. What people are arguing for is an advisory mission, a training mission, and a special commando-type mission to do raids, you know, special forces, but not, you know, with a short cutoff. Because 2016 is a relatively short amount of time. That is something new. And I think what that follows is his thinking that we've already spent a lot of money in Afghanistan. We've spent a lot of blood and treasure, and we're at the point of diminishing returns. You know, he argues it very strongly that the Afghans should do the fighting, that we can't stay indefinitely in these foreign countries. And one of the things that he argues is we can't afford it, that you have to take into account the cost.
This comes before any kind of bilateral security agreement is signed with Afghan authorities. And, of course, they're in the throes of electing a new president. So what do you make of the timing?
He's putting markers for the Afghans. You know, he doesn't want expectations that are not going to be met on the part of the new Afghan leadership. Everything I've read and every indication is that no matter who wins the presidential election, they've all said they're going to sign the agreement. That's not an issue. That being the fact, then I think what Obama is doing is he's setting markers for the kind of continuing presence that we're going to have. And he's telling them in advance, I don't want to have a 10-year presence.
Reuters interviewed the top U.S. officer, General Martin Dempsey, on his way to the United Arab Emirates. He said the United States believes Afghanistan now, with this new plan, has time to develop a reliable counterterrorism force before the end of 2016, and also said that the Afghan and Pakistan military chiefs expressed great relief at the announcement of this plan.
Developing a counterinsurgency capability and a counterterrorism capability is something that's going to take time. You know, the Afghan army, a lot of people have actually made the assessment that they're doing, you know, fairly well. Actually, there was a lot of doom and gloom at one point, but I think a lot of the assessments that are being done that I've seen is that they're doing okay. A lot of people talk about the Taliban fighting season and all that. You know, the Taliban is not really fighting very much. I mean, what they do is terrorism, you know, and I think we mistake the violence of terrorism for military force. Those are two very distinct things. And I would argue that the uptick of terrorism that the Taliban is doing, the assassinations, the shooting down of unarmed civilians and all these things that they do, the bombs, you know, suicide bombs, all of these things to me are a sign of weakness. And I think that's highly significant for the role that the Taliban is going to play in the new Afghanistan. It's going to be a limited role because they don't have a lot of popular support and they don't have a lot of military power. The point is to maintain the edge that the Afghan army has over the Taliban at present. The Achilles heel here is logistics. Now, this is where a lot of people are now, you know, making doom and gloom assessments, that they're not going to have the helicopter capability to evacuate wounded, for example, that they're not going to be able to have the kind of air support for combat missions. In other words, the whole logistical apparatus that the U.S., you know, has provided to the Afghans is being removed.
Munoz says Afghan security forces face more than just the Taliban challenge, but also competing warlords and their armed militia. He asked, with the 2-year timeline of withdrawing most U.S. forces announced by President Obama, will the West maintain its aid commitment to Afghanistan? He expresses concern that with the drawdown of international forces, the aid commitment will also be cut across the board. Still ahead, Egypt's extended presidential voting and the latest on the kidnapped girls in Nigeria.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Early results in Egypt's presidential election show former army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi heading for an overwhelming victory. First results give Sisi about 93% of the vote, while the only other candidate, leftist politician Hamdine Sabahi, has around 3% of the vote. In all, there are 54 million eligible voters in Egypt, and about 44% turned out to cast ballots. This is a significant drop from the 52% who participated during the 2012 election won by ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. Mr. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood had urged Egyptians to boycott this week's voting. A high voter turnout had been seen as key to legitimizing Sisi's long-assumed win in a process that began when he led the army's ouster, Mr. Morsi, last July. The two-day vote originally was due to end on Tuesday, but was extended through Wednesday to allow for more participants. Eric Bornland, head of the Democracy International Observer Mission, which has been in Egypt for the election, is concerned about the decision to extend the voting to a third day.
Well, we think that this decision raises more questions about the impartiality, the independence of the Election Commission, the impartiality of the government, and the integrity of the election process.
Egypt has seen 3 years of political turmoil since the popular uprising that pushed former leader Hosni Mubarak from power in early 2011. Since the Morsi ouster, an army-backed interim government has been overseeing a roadmap for a new constitution and elections for president and parliament. Voters overwhelmingly approved a referendum on the constitution in January, and the vote for parliament is expected later this year. Muslim rebels have killed at least 11 people seeking refuge in a church in the Central African Republic's capital, Bangui. It was the worst attack blamed on Muslims since their Salika rebels group ousted from power in January. Chaos and violence has run rampant in the CAR since Salika rebels seized power last year. They began looting and killing Christians who formed a militia that launched reprisals against Muslim civilians. Thousands of Muslims have fled for their lives from Bangui. Rival groups clashed on Wednesday during a peaceful demonstration in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Each group is calling for the release of more than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls who were abducted by Boko Haram militants more than a month ago. The group that organized the protests called Bring Back Our Girls accused the government of hiring thugs to disrupt their daily meetings. Protest organizer Obiageli Ezekwesili.
What we see here today is a throwback to the an inglorious era in this country, and it was the military era that we last saw this kind of an abuse. Look at these citizens. They are being abused by their own government.
Also on Wednesday in New York, dozens of teenage girls protested in front of the Nigerian consulate to put pressure on the Nigerian government to take action to free the abducted girls. This is a 15-year-old protester named Yashevet Jacobs.
People might say that they're going ahead and the government is thinking and talking about what things to do, but they need to take action. They need to actually do something about it. So we're here to put pressure on the government.
Nigeria's military and government has faced a national and international outrage over their failure to rescue the girls seized by Boko Haram from a remote northeastern school 6 weeks ago. Country's military chiefs and the president are apparently split over how to free the girls, with the military saying use of force endangers the hostages, and the president reportedly ruling out a prisoner-hostage swap. In a majority of African countries, at least 30% of the girls are married before the age of 18, often against their own will. Marta van der Wolf reporting now from Addis Ababa, the rate has led the African Union to launch a 2-year campaign to end child marriage in Africa.
14 million girls below the age of 18 are forced into marriage each year by their parents in developing countries. Most of these countries are in Africa. Zanabu is a 16-year-old girl from Niger. She says that she was taken out of school by her parents to get married, but her husband would beat her if she didn't want him to touch her. She ran away to her parents, but they would also beat her and return her to the husband. She says she eventually ran away to an aunt and wants to go back to school. Girls married at a young age often have mental anguish, suffer health problems due to early pregnancies, and are less likely to get an education. Most of them come from poorly educated families and rural areas where girls cannot oppose the cultural norms of the family and community. The African Union campaign to end child marriage is focused on policy action and raising continental awareness. The director of the AU Social Affairs Commission, Olawe Maigun, says member states of the AU should follow and implement legal frameworks that protect children.
The Charter on the Rights of the Child, for example, has clear provisions on harmful practices against the child. And it's clear in the provisions of the Charter, culture or religious or whatever should not be an excuse, and the states must take measures to eliminate them. People use all sorts of excuses to perpetuate what they're doing, but it's not an excuse as far as the commission is concerned.
Among African countries, child marriage rates are highest in Niger and Chad, with rates above 70%. In Zambia, the rate is 42%. 10 government ministries, including health, education, and legal affairs, are working together to bring that rate down. Zambian Minister of Chiefs and Traditional Affairs, Nkandu Luyo, says traditional chiefs are also trying to change the cultural norm about child marriage in the country.
The reason we felt that the chiefs should be the ones is because it hinges on customary law, and there's also a belief that it is to do with our cultures. When any parent is reported to the chief, first of all, they appear before the chief, because there's the traditional court. So they appear before the traditional court and they are charged according to the decision by the traditional court. But they also make sure they go and take that child out of marriage and put her back into school.
The End Child Marriage campaign of the AU is done in cooperation with African governments, UNICEF, and civil society organizations. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Also in the news, UN Security Council members have overwhelmingly praised Sunday's election in Ukraine. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the UN in New York.
Nearly all 15 council members welcomed President-elect Petro Poroshenko's election victory and his pledge to reach out to all regions as well as Moscow to restore calm. But Russia's ambassador Vitaly Churkin was more reserved, saying the election was not a panacea. UN political chief Jeffrey Feltman told the council that about 60% of eligible voters participated in the election. He said international monitors concluded the vote was credible, despite hostilities in the eastern Donetsk and Luhansk regions of the country. Elections were not held at all in the Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula. Feltman said UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke by telephone with the president-elect Wednesday, congratulating him on receiving a strong mandate from the people.
The Secretary General welcomed President-elect Poroshenko's statements to engage immediately in dialogue and de-escalation.
But Feltman said the UN chief is also concerned about reports of heavy weaponry being used in the east and allegations of arms, fighters, and trucks entering Ukraine. He also expressed concern about four international monitors who have been missing since Monday night in the volatile Donetsk region. Another group of 11 observers was briefly detained Wednesday in the same area, but has since been released. Ukraine's envoy, Yuri Sergeyev, told the council that support for Mr. Poroshenko from all regions of the country confirms the strong desire of Ukrainians for national unity. And he urged Russia to cease its interference and stoking of separatism in Ukraine.
We call on Security Council and the international community to categorically demand from Russian Federation to cease the practice of provoking instability, to withdraw all formations of Russian armed forces, paramilitary organizations, groups, and their citizens from Ukraine, and to fulfill the obligations it undertook in accordance with the Geneva-Ukraine Agreement.
Ambassador Sergeyev said he is skeptical of Moscow's statements that it will respect the outcome of Ukraine's election in light of continued Russian interference. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Poet, author, and human rights activist Maya Angelou, who died Wednesday at the age of 86, was considered by many a literary giant. But to residents of Harlem, a largely African-American New York neighborhood where she sometimes lived, the author is especially mourned. VOA's Adam Phillips has our report.
While Maya Angelou received dozens of awards and honorary degrees, she came from the humblest of beginnings in the racially segregated South, having worked as a streetcar conductor, fry cook, and calypso performer, among other jobs, during her youth. On a city bus riding through Harlem, Raina Clay Cuffee remembered Angelou from a half century ago when they were both nightclub singers.
And of course, years have come by, you know, and then I was there when she spoke at the inauguration for Clinton. So she's been around a long time. She's a wonderful woman, extremely intelligent, and she has used her intelligence for the world.
You feel sad that she died?
Oh, God, yeah.
Jonathan, who was also riding the bus, admired Angelou for her wisdom and compassion. He said that while her writing often expressed the challenges she and other African Americans faced in their struggle for equality, Angelou felt an underlying bond to all peoples.
And it can coexist in one, you know? Okay. So people who make the mistake of always saying that race did this or that race ain't no good, but we're one human race. And that's what she understood.
On 125th Street, Harlem's busy main thoroughfare, Lord Harrison, a hip-hop artist, sold his CDs to passersby. He credited Maya Angelou's poetry and public acclaim with helping to pioneer his musical genre.
She paved the way. Without her doing her thing and opening the way and busting the moves, like we like to say, hip-hop wouldn't be invented. It wouldn't have happened. She did it, and she's a true American icon.
Nearby, the marquee of the famed Apollo Theater, where the Jackson 5, James Brown, Aretha Franklin, and other stars played, noted in big black letters Maya Angelou's passing. In-house historian Billy Mitchell, who has worked there for 49 years, remembers meeting her.
What a regal lady she was. Very graceful, that beautiful smile. You know, how are you, young man? You know, I could have melted right then and there, you know, because I meet so many people here. And there are just a few that really make me feel a little, you know, strange and giddy and groupie-like. And she was one of those people that did that for me, absolutely.
We all adored Maya. Her words made us feel proud. She understood struggle. She understood what it was like to be poor, to be hungry. And she made something of herself. Young kids are still reciting her poetry. You know, still I rise, you know. Still I rise, I rise, I rise.
Plans for Maya Angelou's funeral have not been released. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And many thanks you, Adam. Very nice report. And thanks, everyone, for tuning into the Voice of America today for International Edition. We're always happy to have you with us. And a reminder, you can find us on the Internet, that is, anytime at voanews.com, including Adam's report. We hope you'll stay tuned for the latest world news coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We're going to leave you now with a bit of Maya Angelou singing Miss Calypso from her first album back in 1957. Have a great Thursday, everyone.
Gather around me, all señoras and señoritas, bambinos, caballeros, and chiquitas. You must listen very carefully to the song I'm going to sing if you want to avoid the terrible disaster next door neighbor can bring. Neighbor, neighbor, leave me door. I don't want you here no more. I don't like your company. Get away, fly, don't bother me. He comes to my house whenever he please. Eat up all me rice and peas. Drink up all me gin and rum. Talk me till I'm deaf and dumb. So neighbor, neighbor, leave me door. I don't want you here no more. I don't like your company. Get away, fly, don't bother me. You tell me, Maya, Maya, I like the way you sing. I would buy you anything. I would buy you a foreign car, but I don't believe in traveling that far. Well, neighbor, neighbor, leave me door. I don't want you here no more. I don't like your company. Get away, fly, don't bother me. Maya, Maya, I am all alone. Take me to your island home. He forgot to inform me. He's got a wife that's 6'3". So neighbor, neighbor, leave me door. I don't want you here no more. I don't like your company. Get away, fly. Get out of here, fly. Shoo, you fly. Don't bother me.
This is Today in History. On May 29th, 1453, Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire, fell to Islamic forces led by Sultan Mehmed II. The city was renamed Istanbul. In 1660, King Charles II was restored to the throne of England, Scotland, and Ireland. He fled Britain in 1651 after being defeated in battle by Oliver Cromwell during the English Civil War. In the confusion that resulted following Cromwell's death 9 years later, Charles was invited back to regain the throne. On this day in 1736, Virginia planter, lawyer, and politician Patrick Henry was born. Henry was an eloquent advocate for independence for Britain's North American colonies, proclaiming, "Give me liberty or give me death." In 1903, future entertainer Leslie Towns Hope was born in England. After his family moved to the United States, he adopted the nickname Bob. Bob Hope had major dramatic roles on screen and on stage, as well as on radio and television. He is remembered for bringing entertainment to American troops for 60 years, beginning with World War II and continuing through the Persian Gulf War. In 1913, Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring had its premiere performance in Paris, France. The avant-garde nature of the music angered the audience and provoked a riot, but the piece has since been considered one of the most influential compositions of the 20th century. On this day in 1917, former U.S. President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was born. Kennedy was the first Roman Catholic and one of the youngest men to serve as president. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ukrainians went to the polls by the millions to elect a new president. Voters handed an absolute majority to Petro Poroshenko. In Election Day remarks, President-elect Poroshenko said his early days in office will concentrate on ending the war, ending the chaos, ending the disorder, and bringing peace to Ukrainian soil, to a united, single Ukraine. He also promised to reach out to Russia. The United States congratulates the people of Ukraine for making their voices heard. Despite provocations and violence, said President Barack Obama, millions of Ukrainians went to the polls throughout the country. The large turnout sends a clear message, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. The Ukrainian people want to live in a united, democratic, and peaceful Ukraine anchored in European institutions. Observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, and other international observers noted that the election demonstrated the clear resolve of authorities to hold what was a genuine election, largely in line with international commitments and with a respect for fundamental freedoms in the vast majority of the country. The security situation and outright armed intimidation by separatist groups prevented some voters in two of Ukraine's regions in the east from participating in the polling, while voting was also prevented in occupied Crimea. The United States commends the courage and determination of those in Donetsk and Luhansk who ensured voting did take place in some precincts. The successful conduct of this election demonstrates Ukraine's commitment to the democratic process. The United States looks forward to working with President-elect Poroshenko, as well as a democratically elected parliament, to support Ukraine's efforts to enact important political and economic reforms. The United States continues to support Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and to condemn and reject Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea, and remains committed to working with Ukraine and other partners to find a peaceful resolution to the conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.